San Francisco.
Let me in. I want to be closer to you. Open up your soul. Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. We are sliding into the holiday season, and there's all kinds of holiday shows out there for you to enjoy and for you to take your family to. One such show is kind of an annual event. The Simone Ballet puts on a Christmas show. Here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome the artistic director, Amy Stewart. Welcome.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well today. And yourself?
I'm doing great. But I want to hear about this Christmas ballet. First of all, how long have you guys been doing Smuin's Christmas ballet? And is it Smuin or is it Schmuin?
Muin, so SM, yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, the ballet has been going on for about 30 years.
Wow.
And have you ever been?
Me personally? No, I have not.
Well, you have to come.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a Nutcracker alternative.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is some really, you know, hardcore classical ballet technique and artistic nuance and all these things. But when our founder, Michael Smuin, conceived of the work 30 years ago, he broke it into two acts. And mm-hmm. the first act is called the Classical Christmas.
Okay.
It's all in white. It's got those kind of grand, sweeping Western European kind of Christmas carols going on. It's Bach, Vivaldi, everything there.
Mm-hmm.
But then everything shifts when you go into the second act, and it's called the Cool Christmas. And it's all pop songs. It's got the iconic Santa Baby that he made, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's really just a time for laughter and joy.
Excellent. So let's talk about the history of Smuin. So give us a little background.
Yeah, so Smuin Ballet was the brainchild of Michael Smuin. He started the company back in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a vehicle for his own work right back then. He had been the co-artistic director for San Francisco Ballet for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
He'd also done some Broadway work, some movie work, and he came back to San Francisco and wanted to create on a smaller scale, right? So San Francisco Ballet had a huge company, opera house stage, everything else, a ton of dancers. And with Smuin, we're a smaller company, 16 dancers, and we perform in these more intimate houses. So you really have a close connection to the dancer and what's happening on stage. And Michael left us. He passed away in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And Celia Fischiel, who was his associate artistic director, she took over the company and retired about a year and a half ago. And now I'm in her shoes.
And when did you join Smuin? Did you join during the transition or before that?
Before that, so I had been a dancer with the company. I worked with Michael back. I joined the company in 99, mm-hmm. and I danced for the company until 2008. So 8 years with him, and then 1 year after he passed. And then I retired from dancing and became the company's choreographer in residence, which I did for 10 years. And now I am their artistic director.
Now, what does an artistic director do?
What doesn't an artistic director
okay.
do? No, it's really a fabulous job. So it's really my job and my privilege to set the artistic vision of the company. So to build off of Michael's legacy, which was a lot about the creation and excitement of world premiere ballets, and really an exploration of classical ballet language, but what other dialect it can be spoken with. Michael was very big on exploring different non-traditional music choices and movements for the work that he did. And to keep that legacy of creation going is pretty fantastic.
Now, you talk about the language and the way it can be spoken, the different ways. So what are the different ways that we as lay people might not be aware of?
Well, I think a lot of people have an idea of ballet that it's like some secret clubhouse that you need to, you know, a password to get into or something like that. And Michael was really, really passionate about ballet being for everyone, and that when you look at the people dancing on stage, you see humans that you recognize. Mm-hmm. You see stories that make sense to today, not 300 years ago. So, you know, not afraid of pop culture and ballet, you know, intertwining, mm-hmm. which is something that was very divisive when he started doing it. And it's nice to see that it's a little more welcome now out in the world.
Interesting. Why was it such a divisive stance to take?
It's a good question. I think some people really just wanted to see ballet as a museum piece, and it should only look one way.
Mm-hmm.
And that one way is, I mean, you see a old school classical ballet like Swan Lake done well. It's exciting and beautiful and breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
But what people don't always remember is one time that ballet was a world premiere too.
Mm.
Like it hasn't existed through all of space and time. So I think what Michael really did was he was passionate about continually exploring what's next and what else ballet can be.
Okay. So now let's fast forward. Talk more about what we will see in this ballet.
Okay. So the Christmas ballet is different every year. It's not like going to a museum piece that's going to look the same this year versus 10 years ago versus 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first year, Michael conceived of it, and he made every piece in it. And it was all, some of it was from work he had made back at San Francisco Ballet, but most of it was brand new. So he built this entire production from scratch.
Okay.
And then the next year, he took a couple pieces out and made a couple new pieces. Then the year after that, he did the same thing. So every year, he made 2 to 3 pieces for this ballet. And then when he passed away, Celia, my predecessor, she kept the same tradition going by commissioning different pieces and different mm-hmm. people to come in and create every year.
Mm.
So the ballet, there's about 28 different pieces in it each year.
Wow. Okay.
But a total of 113 different pieces have been made for this ballet over the past 30 years.
Wow.
So Michael made over 50 of those, but, you know, we've had 26 different guest choreographers in there. This year we'll have 8 different choreographers. We have world premieres by Miles Spatcher and Julia Adam, both who have great choreographic history with San Francisco Ballet. But this will be the first time either one of them have created with Smuin. I have a world premiere this year. It's the 18th one I've made for Christmas Ballet.
Wow.
So it's great because I feel like the audience has a sense of surprise every time they come in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, you said that when he was doing it, he would each year commission something new, but there'd be a little bit left over from the year before. So it's like the year before was like a sourdough starter. So
that's a great analogy.
So this year, or when you guys took it over, was it the same way, or would you do entirely different things each time?
No, every year the show is about 30 to 40% different than it was last year.
So it is the sourdough starter each year.
Yeah. I had someone describe it to me, like, if you have a Christmas tree and you have too many ornaments, and every year you have to decide which ones you're going to put on and which ones you're maybe going to keep in the box.
Right. And plus the new ones, they keep getting added. Well, that's great. So how many, so you said you have 16 dancers. Are they all in the show this year?
Oh, yes. Every show, every night.
Okay. And so I'm not familiar with, do you guys have a permanent place where you guys perform?
So we perform all around the Bay Area. So we'll open this show next Saturday out in Walnut Creek at the Lesher Center for the Arts.
Okay, know it well.
Then we head down south to Carmel. We'll do that at the Sunset Center. Then over to Mountain View at the Mountain View Center for the Arts, finally winding up at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts.
When are you going to be at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts?
We are there December 18th through the 28th.
Excellent. So the name of the show is just a Christmas ballet?
The Christmas Ballet.
So if people want to go to the Christmas Ballet at any of the locations that you just mentioned, how would they go about, A, getting tickets, finding out what time it is, and all of the details?
Yes. So neonballet.org is our website, and that'll get you all the information on tickets. And I'd also love to point out we have two things I think are pretty special. We have an audio description for our hard of hearing patrons and, hard of visually impaired patrons and ASL for hard of hearing patrons on different performances in San Francisco.
Oh, very cool. But so they would go to your website. Once again, when for the show in Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, and roughly what days for the other shows?
So Walnut Creek, November 22nd to 23rd, Carmel, December 5th and 6th, Mountain View Center for the Arts, December 11th through the 14th, and then San Francisco starting December 18th.
Excellent. And now for people who know an aspiring ballet dancer, are there auditions for Smoon, or how do you get your people?
Yeah, so we have auditions every spring, and those will start February next year. That'll be posted on our website soon. We audition here in San Francisco, in Chicago, and also in New York.
Excellent. Well, is there any other thing you would want our listening audience to know about this show?
We do have one non-traditional version of this show. It'll be December 27th this year. That's Saturday night. Mm-hmm. We have a show that is specifically gifted for our LGBTQ plus community, and it is hosted by the one and only Lady Camden, who was a first runner-up on RuPaul's Drag Race a couple years ago.
Excellent.
Who also happens to be a former dancer with our company.
Nice. And that night again is when?
That is December 27th.
And where will that be?
Also at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts.
Excellent. Well, Amy Stewart, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check it out. And here's a piece by Kitka. It's called Ma Navu. I hope you like it.
is real to me. It thrills me with perfect liberty. When you tell me you love me and you hold me and kiss me, then I know it's real, real. It's so real to me. Say real, real. Our love is real to me. Please thrill me with your kisses, sweet. Tell your papa and your mama, one day soon we're gonna have a great wedding day. It's so real to me. I say real. Real, our love is real to me. It gives me perfect liberty. When you tell me you love me and you hold me and kiss me, then I know it's real. It's so real to me. I say real now, real. It's so real to me. Thrill me with your kisses, sweet. Tell your papa and your mama, one day soon we're gonna have a great wedding day. So real, so real, so real, so real. It's so real, so real. It's so real to me.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. That was Nina Simone and Real, Real from the beautiful The Blues. And we also got to hear Kitka and Manavu. Hey, it's 20 minutes past the hour of noon, and who's about to touch your mind? Well, the opera does, one of the operas that we were all familiar with is Madame Butterfly, and I'm fortunate enough to have one of the people who is singing in Madame Butterfly. I'd like to welcome, but before I do welcome, I'd like to say that it is the opera that is going to be happening very, very shortly. In you're going to love it. And I'd like to welcome the fabulous Eugene Branco. Covano, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. I know I butchered your name, so can you say it properly so that our listening audience knows who to appreciate?
Certainly. It's a Romanian name, mm-hmm. and it's pronounced Brancoviano.
Brancoviano. Thank you so much. So you are an opera singer.
That's right. I've been an opera singer ever since I was 14 years old.
Wow.
Not knowing that my life would take all these twists and turns that have brought me here with you this morning.
So what drew you to opera? Because normally young people are more drawn toward rock and roll or hip hop or soul or things like that.
I can only agree with you. Well, for us opera singers, opera is very rock and roll because it's the symbiosis of all the art forms. We get to dance and sing and act, wear costumes, be in makeup, special effects, lighting, sets. There's a live audience. It is the famous point of no return every time we open our mouth. So there is no thrill for either us on stage or the people in the audience like being in an opera.
So what drew you to it as a youngster?
When I was 14, you know, I needed an emotional outlet for all that Romanian, Transylvanian energy. And opera just seemed to call my name. And my mother was wise enough to never shush me. And my father, who's an accomplished pianist and astrophysicist, they all gave me the thumbs up and said, you know, it's your life, live your life, follow your heart and dreams. And the opera just is a perfect vehicle for all of that. And Phantom of the Opera and Les Miserables Greece and musicals, the big classical musicals, was it that did it to me at first. Mm-hmm. And then when I turned 18, I specialized almost entirely into just opera.
What was your first opera where you felt like, I'm an opera singer now?
Probably the opera La Boheme, which I sang for the first time in 1996 in Heidelberg, the town I grew up in, Germany. And it's also by Puccini. And little did I know that that opera was going to become the opera that I would perform most in my life.
Mm.
And it's the story, of course, of the young Bohemians in a little garret in Paris. And these are lonely artists starving from one day to another, literally feast to famine. And it spoke to every fiber in who I am, who I was emotionally back then and still today.
Wow. So you've been traveling all over the world. How did you end up coming to the U.S.?
When, again, with La Boheme, before we premiered Baz Luhrmann's production of Puccini's La Boheme on Broadway, we were doing previews at the Koran Theater in San Francisco. And I immediately fell in love with the Bay Area, and the California weather is so forgiving.
Yes.
Where the East Coast weather is very unforgiving. And I felt a kinship with the people in California, their open-mindedness, the level of enthusiasm about the culture and generally the artistic spirit. So that after our run on Broadway was over, I returned to San Francisco, became an Adler Fellow, which is a young artist. And then both my children grew up in San Francisco. And I decided to just stay. And then for the last 11, almost 12 years, Opera San Jose has been a wonderful home base for me artistically.
Excellent. So now we're fast forwarding. You are with Opera San Jose doing Madame Butterfly. And what is your character?
My character's name is Sharpless, and he's the ambassador, the American ambassador in Nagasaki. And we have altered the timeline ever so slightly where it is the year 1902 when we first meet Chocho-san, the famous Madame Butterfly, Pinkerton, Lieutenant Pinkerton, who is my friend, and he is embarking on this wedding to Chocho-san, and I alert him to the fact that he cannot be flippant about this wedding of this arranged marriage, but that he has to take this very serious because she is fully invested emotionally and, of course, physically in this wedding. And as the time goes by, Sharpless is left behind in Nagasaki, Japan, constantly being the middleman, having to relay the news, bad news. And it takes longer and longer and longer for Pinkerton to return. And when he finally returns, this is where Sharpless then finally, you know, blows off the handle and grabs Pinkerton and says, I warned you this was going to happen. And I don't want to spoil it for the audience, but, you know, there's a wonderful twist in the middle of the opera where it all comes together and everybody in the theater cannot help but feel so much emotion and empathy for our dear Chocho-san.
So why did the timeline change? When was it originally set, and why did the timeline change?
When Japan, towards the end of the 18th century, started to open up to the Western world somewhat, it, of course, invited a cultural clash that first was not very well known, except, of course, for the people of Japan. And Michel Cuisant, our director, then said it a little bit later, just about 20 years later, so that my character could have had the role of already having been to Japan for maybe a decade or two, as in the slightly wiser, older statesman who now advises the younger, you know, the young man, you know, wanting to take the world by storm and cautioning him and telling him, listen, the customs here are very different and you can't just come in here and bend it to your will because it doesn't work like this in this culture. And so we were able to bridge that gap quite beautifully and introduce some characters that in the original production weren't even originally supposed to be there. Another twist is also that we're, in the very first few seconds, showing a time warp, like you're being tossed into a time machine where you see the consequences of the actions taken throughout the opera being paid up front. And again, I don't want to spoil it too much, but it is beautiful the way it's done, and it's a feast for the eye.
So when was Madame Butterfly originally written?
Well, Madame Butterfly in and of itself went through several iterations, actually five different versions. And the version that we know to this day is the one that was premiered on 11th of February 1907, where the composer, Giacomo Puccini, was also present. And it was then in the version that we're singing at Opera San Jose at the Metropolitan Opera. Because in 1904, so 3 years prior, it was an absolute disaster, even more so in Italy, where for days on end, Puccini's sister wrote in a letter he couldn't sleep because he felt so humiliated by the flop that this opera was in. And to this day, now, Madame Butterfly, together with La Bohème, is one of the most performed operas in opera history.
Why was it a flop?
Because Puccini tried to cram in too much of the story into two acts, as opposed to the way we now sing it in three acts. And he wanted to take out the two intermissions so that it all was in one long go. Because the original play was a one-act play that Puccini saw. And right after he ended up seeing that play in a production in Paris, that one-act play, he went home and started writing the opera right away, probably trying to preserve as much of that brevity of the one-act feel as possible. And he fell flat on his face with it and rewrote the opera heavily, as opposed to just shelving it and saying, okay, this just doesn't work. And we are now the beneficiaries thereof.
Was that his first flop, or was he known for somewhat being long-winded and then having to revisit his works?
Well, Puccini usually was the wonder child. He could do no wrong. And that's why that blow was so tremendous for him. Because all of his other operas leading up until this point were always tremendous successes. Even so much so that even at the time when he was writing an opera called La Bohème, a friend of his, Ruggero Leoncavallo, was also writing an opera called La Bohème, and he didn't mind that somebody was now writing an opera with the same title because he knew he could just blow him out of the water.
Right, right. That's kind of hubris. So I think it's good that he had a little bit of humiliation to maybe make him a better artist.
I think so.
Let's talk about the people who are in the opera with you. Talk about your opera performers.
It's a stellar cast, if you bear with me. So our Cho-Cho-San is Emily Michiko Jensen. She sings Cho-Cho-San, a phenomenal voice who just makes this colossal role seem effortless and with a radiant, radiant voice. That just tugs at my heart every time I listen to her. The same can be said about Kayla Nanto, who sings the role of Suzuki. And then my dear friend Christopher Oglesby, who the Bay Area audience will have also seen in the recent Parsifal at Opera San Jose, and at San Francisco Opera, of course, not Opera San Jose. So dear Chris was going back and forth between San Francisco and San Jose. And then in the role of Goro, we have Ilhi Lee, who is a Korean tenor, who was also covering for Christopher.
Very cool. cool. Very cool. So have you already started performances or?
Yes, we had our opening night yesterday to great acclaim, if I may say so.
Yay.
When we took our final bows, it really felt as if we had just scored at the Super Bowl. So that was really lovely.
Nice, nice. So for people who now are dying to go see it, where and when for Madame Butterfly?
Wonderful. So we have four more performances. Friday, November the 21st at 7:30 p.m. So that's an evening performance.
Okay.
Then Sunday, November 23rd at 2 p.m., a matinee performance.
Mm-hmm.
Saturday, November 29th, so 2 days after Thanksgiving, a matinee as opposed to an evening. And then Sunday, a day after, November 30th, also 2 p.m., and that's at the California Theater in San Jose. And tickets can be purchased on the website operasj.org. So that's opera, O-P-E-R-A-S-J dot O-R-G. And if you click onto Madame Butterfly, you can go to dates and tickets. And even more important, if you want to subscribe to a season, to a season subscription, and there are lots of perks and fabulous other offers on hand.
And if people want to find out more about you, do you have an online presence?
Yes, I do. So if you type in my name, Eugene Brancoviano, into the Google machine or on YouTube, you will find, you know, several listings there. Luckily, the AI robots have not turned me into superheroes flying across the sky yet, but I'm sure that's not far off either.
Okay. Well, Eugene Brancoviano, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. It was a delight.
Thank you. All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out Madame Butterfly. I really want to see it, so I'm going to see if I can Bogart my way into the mix. I don't want to spoil the opera for you, but I'm going to play the 80s like club version. This is Malcolm McLaren and Madame Butterfly. So enjoy it.
Back in Nagasaki, I got married to Cho-Cho San. That was her name in those days when I was her man. I've gone back to visit her, but she got a problem. She got a little Cho-Cho. Cho-Cho San was her name, and Mr. Taylor Wolf. Take it away, Cho-Cho. Thank you. married a Yankee girl. But I went back to visit old Japan, where there she was, Cho-Cho San.
Gotta have something to believe in. My white honky, I do miss him. Someday soon he'll come around, just to stop my nervous breakdown. Call me fool, call me stupid. Spend my hour, kill this Cuban. Say it with me.
Hey, I have faith in this love train.
Malcolm McLaren, Madam Butterfly. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. You know, we talked about Lesbo Solo a few weeks ago, and it's still going on. So we thought we'd revisit it, and here to talk about it, I'd like to welcome Terry Baum. How are you?
I'm wonderful.
So, Terry, give our listening audience a little bit of your pedigree. Like, how did you get into acting
and one-woman
performances and writing and all of that?
Well, I feel everybody starts out in acting in their childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You're game playing games, playing house, playing cowgirls, whatever. You're acting.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I never stopped. So you got out of theater at some point, and I never did.
I'm still in theater. It's just that I'm doing it sporadically, whereas you made it a
yeah, like, it's the center of my life, actually, and I've had the great blessing to be able to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I got into directing from writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I never got cast in anything.
Aww.
Everybody was young and beautiful and sweet looking, and I just wasn't that whatever. You
know? Had an edge.
Yeah. So I started directing and discovered I was very good at it. And then mm-hmm. I became a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was nothing I wanted to direct.
Okay.
I mean, that was a long time ago. So everything written between 1968 and now, it wasn't available to me. So that's when I started creating my own material.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm curious because I'm old enough to have seen the transition with feminism where people sort of treated it very dismissively or mm-hmm. with like sneering humor to now where notwithstanding the vitriol that comes aimed at feminism, like
yeah.
like things that you sort of take for granted now were
absolutely
I remember how people would go Ms. like it was some like you know like they were smelling something bad.
People don't understand. Women didn't even used to exist actually when you know I was growing up. It was man this, man that, man you know does this, and I always understood that I was not included in man.
Right. Fireman, policeman.
Well, but just man as the generic for human.
Mm.
That's, you know, when somebody wrote a book on anthropology, he didn't talk about people. He talked about man.
Right.
You know, and we don't understand. I mean, all these incredible women in these high positions, like when I went to the opera, and the conductor of the opera is a woman and absolutely adored, mm-hmm. and this great coup that the San Francisco Opera has her. I mean, there were no women conductors. None. Zero. That was it. You know, so all of those things have been transformed, and we are now facing the backlash to that transformation, because at that time, when we were growing up, everything belonged to white men, and that was how it was.
So did your plays at the time reflect that, or was that how does what you wrote back in the day when it was hard to be a feminist and you were fighting, how does that differ from the stuff that you write now?
Well, for one thing, I wasn't a lesbian then.
Okay.
So that was a huge difference.
All right.
But I mean, when I started creating my own stuff, I created Lilith Feminist Theater,
mm-hmm.
which was all women. So we had an explicit feminist identity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our, we did in 1976, we started in 1974, 1976, mm-hmm. we did a play on women and work.
Okay.
And that was like a novel idea. Of course women were working,
mm-hmm.
but the ideology was that women did not work. So it was never talked about. So, you know, that was a radical thing to do, to show women working. So, I mean, it's hard to believe that nowadays, that even though women were working, they were not ever acknowledged. Like, about, 6 months after we did Moonlighting, which was our play on women working, Time Magazine did a whole issue on women working, acknowledging that women worked 6 months after, you know. And I only remember that so clearly because one of the women in the cast said, "Terry beat Time Magazine by 6 months." So it's a completely different world now, really. But for me, the huge thing was coming out as a lesbian,
mm-hmm.
and then of course there was just nothing at all,
mm.
no images of lesbians except for pathetic, tormented women who killed themselves and
Children's
evil
hour.
Vampires.
Mm.
That's kind of that's kind of a trope.
Mm-hmm.
Evil lesbian vampires. So it was sort of, there is underneath the culture the idea that the most evil person is a lesbian.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although I do enjoy evil lesbian vampire movies, but that's because I enjoy vampire movies in general.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But no, I hear what you're saying.
To have your only role models
right.
be suicides and evil vampires
right.
is
and you're
a problem.
Like, this doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So then, you saw a vacuum, and
yes.
you were like, I'm going to fill this vacuum
yes.
with quality lesbians.
Yes.
So what was the first thing that you wrote after you came out that addressed that need for positive role models
yeah.
or different
well,
role models?
I'm not into positive in terms of political. I'm into self-mocking.
Sure. Okay.
Very much.
Okay.
Not bright on and not idealized. Always being able to laugh at ourselves and show our flaws. So the first thing was Dos Lesbos.
Okay.
A play by, for, and about perverts.
Okay.
So in 1981, that was kind of radical.
Okay. And was it a one-woman play? Or?
No.
Okay.
It was me and my girlfriend. It was based on our lives together. Alice Thompson, she was totally brilliant and an incredible performer. And then we also had scenes and songs kind of in between the scenes of the lives of Peg and Gracie, who were Alice and me. So we had songs and things like that. Jill the Ripper, we had a whole thing about hating men, you know, violence against men's violence against women. So we had a song about Jill the Ripper, a woman who castrates rapists. And
I can co-sign that.
Yeah. It seemed the way to go. And a lot of it is still pretty radical, actually.
And where were you performing at that time? I mean, was it more guerrilla theater or were
Oh, no. We were renting theaters.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, we were regular theater people. We you know, rent a theater. We rehearse hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And it's an extremely labor-intensive endeavor, live theater.
Okay. Yeah. So let's fast forward to today when you are doing Lesbos Solo. So talk about, what is that about?
Well, my subtitle is The True Life Adventures, My True Life Adventures Through 50 Years of Gay Liberation. So I realized I was doing something for the Fringe. I won the lottery to get in the Fringe Festival in San Francisco last year.
Okay.
And so I had a different idea about what this Lesbos Solo was going to be. I had to submit the title. I had this title, which I had done in South Africa when
I
visited South Africa. I performed in Cape Town and Johannesburg.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of a little anthology of excerpts from my plays, and I thought I was going to do that, but then I had one scene that was my coming out story, and it kind of kicked all the other scenes off a cliff.
Oh, okay.
And I saw that there was the story of what I had experienced and what I had also done and participated in terms of the struggle for gay liberation in the last 50 years. And that was a really important thing. Again, a vacuum existed. I've discovered that very much in terms of the young people who have come to my play. They're just so grateful to have somebody telling some kind of history that is personal and celebratory. Because there's a hell of a lot to celebrate, even though we feel threatened at this moment, you know? So... So that's what Lesbos Solo is. So it shows my coming out story and a lot more than that.
Okay.
Both before it starts in high school when my favorite teacher was rumored to be a lesbian and threatened with being fired.
Because that was during sort of the Anita Bryant?
1963.
Oh, 63, so much earlier.
Really
before
early.
Anita Bryant. Okay.
Yeah. And that was the first time I ever heard the word lesbian. I didn't even know what it was. And I thought it was horrible. I thought she should be fired if she was a lesbian. But I thought she was so intelligent and funny, she couldn't be a lesbian.
Oh, okay. I like her. Therefore, you know.
Yeah.
God, wow.
Yeah, so that's where the play starts with me and society in that place.
So you start where... you are not even aware of your sapphic leanings.
No, not at all. I did not come out until I was 30, but I blame the lesbians for that.
Because they were just too darned enticing?
No, they are. Believe me, they were enticing. They weren't interested.
Aw.
I needed somebody, you know. As I say in the play, I was low-hanging fruit. I was waiting to be plucked, but nobody was interested in plucking me.
Aww.
So I didn't come out until I was 30. Yeah. And then it ends, actually, the final thing is me, which actually happened, I'm going to, I go to the gay synagogue. The oldest gay synagogue in the world is right near my house in Los Angeles, my parents' house. I'm down for the weekend. I go there, and I see this woman who was accused of being a lesbian in 1963.
Your teacher.
My teacher.
Okay.
She is the honored elder in the gay synagogue.
Wow.
So, in fact, she really was a lesbian, but she had to deny it vehemently.
Right.
And even say, how could anyone believe I would do anything so disgusting? And then 50 years later, there she is.
Wow.
Surrounded by people who love her and honor her for having gone through this terrible, terrible time.
And did you approach her?
Oh, yeah. But she didn't recognize me.
No, well, it's been like a million years ago. Yeah.
She was many people's adored teacher. And now, in February, I'm going to be going down and doing this play at the synagogue. Beit Hadish Harashim, BCC. I'm going to be doing this play as a benefit for the synagogue, honoring the synagogue for giving Miss Pearl a home, you know, on a family. It's just, it's very, very moving to me, her story.
Well, we're almost out of time, so I want to make sure you tell our listening audience when and where for Lesbo Solo.
Two more performances.
Mm-hmm.
November 23rd, this Sunday at 2 p.m.
Okay.
And November 30th, the next week at 2 p.m. at the Marsh Berkeley.
Marsh Berkeley.
Which is a half a block from downtown Berkeley BART. And there's also tons of parking garages around there. So very easy transportation and parking. And it's you go to themarsh.org for tickets. And please come. It's people love it. It's very funny. You can see a trailer that will prove that it's funny. And I love doing it. I was very happy that we did well enough to be extended. And it's extremely, it's of course meaningful for anybody, but. And for old lesbians, it's a capsule of our history. But for young people, it's like a revelation.
Excellent.
That's my experience of people's, the audience's reaction.
Well, Terry Baum, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, well, you're very welcome.
All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity. Go check out Lesbo Solo. Mr. Ford is in the house who's going to pleasure your ear hole. I'm going to leave you with Jonah Jones. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Dig chicks, a chick's a man's best friend. I dig chicks, to me chicks are the end. I dig dolls, that's how I get my kicks. Weak ones, strong ones, right ones, wrong ones. I dig chicks, I dig Polly and Molly, and by golly.